Hi, it's Francis Lam, and this week on the podcast, we say goodbye to Lynn. As Lynn Rosetto Casper's time with The Splendid Table comes to an end after two decades of hosting our show, we just couldn't let her go without a special farewell and to celebrate her extraordinary career. So last October, at the beautiful Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota, nearly 1,000 people crowded in to see and celebrate Lynn. I had the pleasure of joining her on stage, and what you'll hear in this podcast is that show. It's virtually uncut, so if you couldn't be there with her, you can feel like you were. Enjoy it. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, a show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lam. On October 12th, in St. Paul, Minnesota, at the beautiful old Fitzgerald Theater, a packed house of 900 people came to hear Lynn Rosetto Casper. It was her farewell show after over 20 years of hosting this program, and after thousands of interviews and listener calls and ideas and stories, we thought we'd give her one night to talk about herself. I joined her on stage to ask her about her career, how she started in food, her friendships with people like a hot young Jacques Pepin, and how she came up alongside the legendary figures who changed how America eats, and how the secret to her start was Chinese food. We only embarrassed her a little bit, I promise, and I hope you enjoy listening to this. And join us in celebrating the career of Lynn Rosetto Casper.
Boy.
Wow.
You know, it was worth the 22 years of work.
That was a good haul. That was a great haul. Lynn Rosetto Casper, ladies and gentlemen.
And Francis Lam. You're here.
Clap a little less. Can I do something? Can I do something that I've always wanted to do? Hello, St. Paul! It is the easiest way to get cheers. It is the best. So thank you all for joining us tonight. We are gathered here today to... We're getting married. Surprise twist. Lynn and I are getting married.
Oh!
That means it's real.
Sorry, it's Francis. I just had to jump in and tell you, at that moment, Lynn dropped an entire glass of water in her lap.
The excitement.
You shook me up.
The excitement.
By the way, now you know what goes on in my kitchen.
Yeah.
Ay vey. Okay, no problem.
Can we get you something here?
No, it's fine. I still have water.
Okay. There's another way to say this, right? We have come together today to celebrate Lynn. To celebrate her for certainly 20 plus years at the Splendid Table, but for many decades of a legendary, fascinating, always curious career in food. And we thought a lot of things. What are we gonna do? Like, we knew we wanted to do this event, but what are we gonna do? And we just thought, well, maybe the best thing to do is to talk to Lynn, because she has given us so much in the way that she talks to people. And we thought we'd take a moment this evening to take a look back with her, to take a look back over this career, over her life, over the things that have driven her, the passions that have driven her, that have brought this show into the world and brought it into our homes for so many years. So let's start from the top.
Okay. What are you thinking?
So when I was digging a little bit into, you know, your past and your life, and not that much. I mean, it wasn't like weird. It was like a perfectly normal amount of Googling. This is what I'll start with. I was surprised to find out that your first interest in food, your first serious, like, intellectual, professional curiosity in food was with Chinese food.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
Well, okay. And it's so funny because Francis is Chinese. He's, yeah.
I want to know what kind of credit I can take.
Okay. All right. Well, basically the story is this. I grew up outside of New Jersey, outside of New York City, in a northern New Jersey town called Paramus. And, really? Wow.
Yeah.
My family is Italian. My last name was Rossetto. And I, by nature, was, shall we say, a tad rebellious. And when you think about, now, there were two things that I really, really wanted to do as a kid, and really all through my teens. I wanted to move into the city, New York, and I wanted to do something completely that had nothing to do with the kind of traditions I was raised with. I did not want to get married and have children. I wanted to do something that was an adventure. Like, getting married and having children is not an adventure, but please excuse me. I was a kid. So anyway, what does a kid do with a last name that most people couldn't pronounce and wants to, is really curious about the world and honestly loves Chinese food? Of course I start to study Chinese cooking. You know, I mean, there was no way that anybody could interpret that of, you know, she's just following her tradition. But the reality was, it's the most, still in my mind, and it's the most profoundly complex cuisine from what I understand in terms of how it plays within the culture, within values. And I may be exaggerating because this is your heritage, but I think you could probably eat a different meal each 3 times a day and not eat everything that comes from China and Chinese tradition. And so one of my first jobs in New York was working for an artist and collector. His name was Bill Copley. Bill had one of the great surrealistic collections in the United States. His story is a half hour, but it was fascinating. And Bill was a professional black sheep in his family. And I was working part-time figuring out what I wanted to do. And I was a part-time secretary. And I went to work for him for like a week. And I stayed 3 years. And Bill had phenomenal art all over the apartment. And one of the things was, I don't know if you're familiar with some of the surrealistic artists from the 30s and the 40s. Max Ernst was one of them. And over my desk was a painting of a pipe floating in a meadow. And in French, underneath it, it said, "This is not a pipe." And as you looked at it, it wasn't. I mean, it was a painting of a pipe. It kind of looked like a pipe, but it did not have to be a pipe. That's what happens, huh?
It was a dumpling.
Well, it was...
I'm just trying to get us back on the Chinese food.
I'm trying to be serious here. I'm really trying to be serious. So at any rate, his wife, Stella Copley, was born and raised in Shanghai, part of a Shanghai banking family. She came from a background where there were cooks in the kitchen, but she would cook herself when very important guests came. I'm name-dropping here, but like the former Jacqueline Kennedy and Aristotle Onassis. So I was her kitchen slave. I had already started eating in Chinatown and loving it. And this was when there was a great immigration from Taiwan. The immigration laws had changed in the 60s. This is the late 60s. Anyway, so I was her kitchen slave. And I would help prep. And these were very special meals. And I still remember chrysanthemum leaves, which are used in the winter. And she had a bushel basket of chrysanthemum leaves, and she showed me how to pluck them and the perfect ones, only the perfect ones. So the bushel basket, my bushel basket went down to like a peck, you know, half a bushel at this big. And then her mother came. And I could not, they were purposely speaking Chinese so that I probably would not know all of the things they were saying. But the mother then came over to me very politely, you know, I don't mean to insult you, and showed me how you're really supposed to work with those chrysanthemum leaves. And I ended up with this much. But that told me something really important, that it was this concept of balance and exact exact dimension, not only of a piece of something, but how it related to what was next to it on that dish. And then along came the Time Life Foods of the World series, which was revolutionary in those days. This, again, is the late 60s. And the China volume, well, I could work with Stella, and then I could go home, and then I could go to Chinatown and show pictures, because nobody in Chinatown cared about talking to you. You know, you were just a pain in the neck. So I could say, I want this, you see. And I started cooking Chinese food. And then we started doing banquets once a month where we researched and cooked and whatever. And then our friend said, would you teach us? And I said, well, it's like the teacher reading the book the night before. And the great line was, you know the book to read. And that's how it began. And that finally led to Julia and Abraham and Strauss. But that's how it began. But, I mean, how do you react to that? Because this is your heritage. I mean, it feels so, it's a little uncomfortable.
Well, I mean, I want to get to actually to the next part of the story, because the next part of the story is you being a teacher. But since you're asking me, because you've spent 22 years asking people questions, and I guess you're going to turn it back around on me. I'm fascinated by it because I think, okay, so I grew up in a Chinese-American family. My parents are immigrants from China. I was born and raised here. And I always felt a little bit, you know, odd, unusual, different. There weren't very many Chinese families where I was growing up at the time, and so I always felt a little bit odd. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's understandable. And you're different.
Different.
And the same with me, though, with the Italian business also.
So this is what's amazing, because I love Italian food. Everyone loves Italian food. Okay, sure. But when I was a kid, I loved Italian food, and I loved Italian food. No, for real, I love Italian food because it was, okay, my favorite dish in Italian food was linguine and clams, right? And here's why. It's noodles with seafood. So
right,
this was food.
Right, of course, it's a natural, isn't
it? I totally understood.
Yeah.
But like white people ate it. And I'm like, I could eat food that white people eat. That's amazing. Maybe
and of
I'll
course,
be like them.
And of course, why would I be drawn to Chinese food? No one like me does this. Well, it turns out very few people at that time, in those days, were cooking Chinese food.
Sure.
And it was that same kind of, you know, for me, I don't know if I wanted to be Chinese, but it did hit me very soon on that if I was going to really focus on this cuisine, A, I had to learn one of the main languages, and I had to go to China. And at that time in my life, it wasn't possible. Hmm. And that's when I turned to Western food, and I studied French cuisine, not because I just wanted to cook French food. I figured if I could figure out how food worked, I could cook anything. And the French seemed to define the structure.
Sure.
Don't you think? Because I know you were at the CIA and you're a trained chef. That structure, the methods, the techniques seem to be defined beautifully by the French.
Yeah. And then you gave everything names. And once you name something, you have power over it.
It's a very good point.
No, yeah. I mean, seriously. Like,
it's true.
Really,
it's called
sauté because the French called it sauté.
And
then it was like, oh, that's a French technique. It's like, well, the more people put food in a pan than you might realize. But, but now...
You see why he's going to be such a good host, I ask you. Yeah, this is great.
But yeah.
So at any rate, we both were coming like this, together more or less.
But actually, so now we're talking about teaching, right?
Right.
We're talking about technique and codifying technique and imparting lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And you went from this career as an art dealer's assistant slash Chinese banquet cook.
Thank you. I'd love
to see the job, like the help wanted posting for that today. But you came to become a renowned cooking teacher, and you ran a cooking program at a department store.
Well, I don't know how renowned I was, but the first department store in the United States to ever have a cooking program that wasn't selling something directly was in Brooklyn, New York. And it's an institution there for families. It's many generations. It's called Abraham and Strauss.
A&S.
A&S, yes. Yeah. And if you were a Brooklynite, and you know, Brooklyn people in the days when we lived there, because you didn't go from Manhattan to Brooklyn, but their great line was, we are not a banana republic. Because people would talk about New York and they totally ignore this wonderful place called Brooklyn. Now it's famous, of course. But at any rate, I
think the ANS became a Banana Republic later, unfortunately.
Yeah. I heard that they were looking for someone to do a Chinese demo. And I called, I was given a name to call, and I called, and we talked, and whatever, and I realized, no, they were looking for someone to show up 5 days a week and do a cooking demonstration in front of people and to talk. And I at that time, had a street theater group that we did improv street theater, and the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Yeah, what?
There's someone's laughing. You brought street theater, and someone's laughing. That's rude.
That's street theater. You know, you put up a sawhorse here and a sawhorse here, and you do theater with the kids. It was great. Anyway, point was that the Brooklyn Academy of Music was actually considering the group as their resident children's theater company, and I and a friend were the directors of it. And then there was this job at Abraham and Strauss where they wanted me to work 5 days a week, you know, like 5 hours, maybe. And I said to my husband, I don't know if I can handle a full-time job and do theater at the same time. And the most, I've said this many times, but this was the most, I think this is such a key to what the Splendid Table Show is about how we all, you and I, approach food, and many of you do. A friend of mine said to me, you know, if the Academy of Music takes this on, there's 20 of you. And if it falls apart or it doesn't, you know, there's 20 of you. But if you take this on, the food thing, there's only you. And if you fall flat on your face, well, you learned a lesson. She said, I don't know anything about food, but I kind of have a feeling it's like the palm of your hand. This is the food, and it can take you in any direction. I mean, I had no idea what my life was going to be like at that point, but that's how it began. But that's how I met James Beard, who many of you maybe have never heard of, but he was really... Sorry. Okay. All right. No, because you're never sure. You know, it was a long time ago. I met James Beard that way. I met Jacques Pepin. Jacques Pepin, in those days, okay, had... Oh, you know. You know. Have you ever seen pictures of him when he was young?
Okay, can we have a real talk moment on Jacques Pepin? Yeah. There was this great, like, hour-long, you know, documentary of him on, like, public television a couple of months ago, whatever I was watching. I was like, oh, wow, this is really fascinating. He'd lived a fascinating life. And they flashed this picture of him, a young Jacques Pepin. Uh-huh. And I tweeted...
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I tweeted... Okay. Don't do it now, because we're here. But after this, maybe during the intermission, go on your phone and Google young Jacques Pepin, because dude looks like a young Marlon Brando, but with, like, musculature and can cook.
Yes.
Like, I tweeted a picture of this dude, and it was, like, thousands of people were like, he is a stone fox. Like,
he
that
was.
Dude, I'm leaving my husband today.
We,
I'm like, Jacques's a little older than that now, guys, but when Jacques Pepin was 25 years, like, I mean, you look at him. Look at him right now.
Yeah, no, but seriously, there's a shot out there of him with his pal, who is now still his dearest friend, two young chefs, but they're in suits, and they're walking down the street in Paris. And I will tell you, first of all, they both were gorgeous, but the vitality of it, it's like, holy cow, I wish I could have dated him then. You know, I mean, but this was the thing. I ran this kitchen in the middle of the housewares department, and, you know, we had people who would come in every year. We would have something called the Gourmet Festival, where all these famous people would come and cook, and you could come and see them for free, and you got free samples and whatever. James Beard came. Now, I have to tell you, I'd been doing the job for about 9 months, and the only thing about it that was that I didn't like, you schlepped shopping bags. I mean, like 8 shopping bags every morning, and I thought, one day, I'm going to be famous, and I'll never schlep a bag again. So it's the first day of the, in quotes, Gourmet Festival, and James Beard is arriving. And sure enough, he had people schlepping, and he had 4 shopping bags in his hands. And I thought, that blew that. But Jacques, at that time, had a small restaurant. He had a soup kitchen on Fifth Avenue. He had left Le Pavillon, which was what brought him here. And he came, and he was introducing something very interesting. We'd never heard of it. It was called the Cuisine Art. And we were marveling. And those were the days, by the way, where the only thing you did in puree was the cat, because everybody got so excited about the Cuisine Art. But what he would
was that a Chinese food joke?
Huh?
Lynn, are you... I thought you respected my people and our culture. Okay, sorry, Jacques. Back to hot Jacques.
What he would do between, we had like two shows a day or three shows a day. He would come up to the offices at Abraham and Strauss with a little hot plate and some eggs and a pan, and he'd make us all omelets. He was so sweet. He was very shy. He was gifted. He was beautiful. And every once in a while, we'd bump into each other. He had been taken under the wing of a woman who was a force of nature, Helen McCauley, who was the food editor at that time of House Beautiful, an older woman who knew the business inside out, knew food inside out. She'd eaten every great restaurant in the world. And she sort of showed him the ropes. And that was the beginning of Jacques Pepin. And it was just amazing. I mean, again, it's startled. We're used to seeing a different person. Sure. And from there, what happened was, I mean, this was an incredible doorway job. Andre Soltner, who maybe none of you know of, there was a restaurant at that time in New York, a very famous one called Lutèce, brilliant French cook, very, very quiet. And I had asked him, how should I begin really understanding this cuisine? And in those days, it was the work of Escoffier, a chef that was from the Ritz in Paris and going back to the beginning of the 20th century. But he had codified, and he said, and I had a copy of his book, and he said, work your way through each thing and call me when you have a question. Well, the reality is, for all my mouthiness, I'm very shy, I was at least then, with people like this. And I never really called him, but what I did do, I started reading everything in sight. Mm. And I started looking, and I started figuring out. And that's how you learn. You know, I mean, you learn in a lot of ways, but it's that, wait a minute. If they're, because those really aren't recipes in this book. How do I fillet the fish to get the fillet? So we had fishmongers in those days. I mean, you could walk into a fish store and they were filleting. And I learned how to cut meat from my butcher in Brooklyn, the old-fashioned butcher. You learn everywhere. And then, I took courses and that kind of thing. But eventually what happened is Julia Child, who was on television, was going to go on tour with her second book. It had just come out, Volume 2 of Mastering the Art. And they wanted to have, she had never cooked in public, and they wanted a large facility, and it was Abraham and Strauss.
That's Lynn Rosetto Casper and me, on stage at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota, for her farewell show. We'll be back with how Lynn's food career really took off, with the help of balsamic vinegar. And by the way, you can hear the full version of our farewell show to Lynn as a podcast, with all the stories you won't hear today. So check it out. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. So today, it's our farewell interview with Lynn, recorded this fall at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota. Now, you can hear the full version of the event on our podcast, but as we get back to the action here on stage, Lynn is telling us about her career and of the start of her friendship with Julia and Paul Child. Now, Lynn was a young teacher then, running a cooking school in New York, and Julia, who was already a superstar, chose that school to launch her new book.
Eventually, what happened is Julia Child, who was on television, was going to go on tour with her second book. It had just come out, Volume 2 of Mastering the Art. And they wanted to have, she had never cooked in public, and they wanted a large facility, and it was Abraham and Strauss. We had to have free seating for 250 people. I was beside myself. I was hosting her. This was, in quotes, my kitchen. First of all, what happened was nobody was prepared for this, which was kind of silly when you think about it. About 700 people camped out, it was summer, outside the store. On the sidewalk the night before, people brought food and wine and tents, and it was an absolute party. I mean, everybody was so agreeable. And so when they arrived, when Julia and Paul and her publisher and her producer all arrived, we were all set. We were very proud. And Paul was the person who made sure everything worked. And he took one look at this kitchen we had set up, which they had sent us blueprints. You know, the outlet goes here and this goes there. And he had said, it's all wrong. I want an electrician here. I need a carpenter. And I think Julia took one look at me, and I worshipped her. and she could see the deer in the headlights. And she said, I was much taller then. And no, but the reality was, here was a woman who I could look up to and who put her arms around my shoulder here and said, tell me, dearie, show me your kitchen. She knew damn well if she didn't get me out of there, I was going to have a meltdown. And my kitchen that I demoed in was upstairs. Well, what happened also that day was that we were going to entertain them at this wonderful old restaurant, a real mainstay in Brooklyn called Gage and Tolner. And we were seated. Paul terrified me. Okay, so we were seated, all the officials from the department store and the publisher and everybody, we were seated in a way you couldn't talk across the table. And Paul was on my right. And, you know, the polite thing to do is you talk to the person on your left and then you talk to the person on your right. Well, the person on my left was talking to somebody else. And I'm faced with Paul, who has me utterly, I mean, my stomach was turning. And he turns to me and he says, have you ever been to Paris? And I had been for the first time the year before. And I had no preparation for Paris. I don't know why it was. I wanted to get to England because theater was one of my great loves. I was bowled over from the moment I put a foot down on the dirt. The ugliest station in Paris is the North Station. I walked out of it in the middle of the night with my husband and went, whoop! I mean, I just let it out. I threw my arms out. I just was in love, and it never went away. But I was thinking to myself, what can I say to him? Because there's only one way you describe Paris. To me, at that time, I was a little tongue-tied. It's so French. And he...
Very true.
It is, very yeah. True. But you know, there are times, I've heard a lot of people say this over the years, Paris is Paris. I mean, there are certain things you cannot describe. They are what they are. And he said to me, and this is when the walls all came down and we all melted. He said, you know, that's exactly how Julia reacted. And he said, and I know what that's like too, because his dream, and he told me the story, he said his dream was to go to China. And he was a writer and he was flying, this was, I think, during World War II. He was flying to China. He was, I think, going to Beijing or somewhere. And the reality was they stopped in Chongqing, which is Western China. And they stopped there for their first stop to refuel. And he had decided that he was going to write down, you know, just stream of consciousness, every impression that he had. And he spent an hour there, or whatever amount of time, just writing, not looking, just writing, folded it up. And when he got back on the plane, he looked. And what he had written was, it's so Chinese. Over and over again. And this was where I mean, the both of us just kind of looked at each other and it was wonderful but it is that sensibility. So from there, anyway, I ended up teaching at another school and then I ended up going to Colorado. We moved to Colorado. And I opened a school in Colorado. This was the very beginning of the food, quote, revolution. And I thought it was going to roll west. Well, I ended up running the largest cooking school in the state if you were not going to restaurant school. And we had a hoot. We covered it. I brought in guest teachers. We did all kinds of things. We actually introduced unsalted fresh butter made from local cream to Denver, Colorado. Don't ask the backstory, but it was amazing. And then from there, the Europe years, my husband worked for Honeywell, and one day he came home on a Friday night, which was our sacred night, because I taught day and night, and he worked. But that was the night that we drank a martini. We knocked off a whole bottle of wine. We never answered the phone. We never went out. And he came home, waited until we were completely done with dinner, and looked at me and said, how would you like to move to Brussels? And it was... I'll be packed in 3 hours. Well, it turns out a colleague of his, a great pal, who was being sent to Brussels from Switzerland, he was Swiss, came into Frank's, the plant where Frank was, and had said, do you know anyone who wants to move to Brussels? Because I want to have someone to work next to me. And Frank said, how about me? And he said, but Lynn has the school, and she's a writer. And he said, she'll be packed in 3 hours. And I would say that Europe really led to the next huge step for me. What had started to open up, it was The Splendid Table, writing the book. Hmm. It was, I was teaching, I was writing, I had started to write a column, and then I wrote for Bon Appetit. Oh, I should tell them the story about the magazine, my first article.
Please do.
This was, you don't have any choice.
This is the easiest interview ever. I'm being paid for this, this is ridiculous. Sure, yeah, go for it.
Oh, all right.
All you.
I never thought I could write, and a friend of mine who was a writer said, you know, the Saturday Evening Post is looking for a food writer. And I ended up submitting a couple of stories that I'd written, you know, fully, and I never heard a word. And I was going down into the subway on Fifth Avenue to go home to Brooklyn, and there was the Saturday Evening Post on the newsstand, and there on the cover was the name of the article I had written. And I flipped through it, and that was the article. And I was so excited, I bought about 8 or 9 copies to make sure it was in all of them. And now I think you wanted to say something, yeah, so I'm sorry.
What I want to say is you should have had an agent, and your agent should have really barked down someone's throat for that.
Yes, I agree, but I didn't.
But no, actually, I want to get to this idea of, you know, so you had been teaching, you had been meeting all these incredible people, these luminaries right. that you had looked up to and who were really driving, you know, so many of the changes in American food culture, mm-hmm. certainly at that time. And, you know, and their legacy is with us today in yeah. all the ways we look at food now. But I want to talk to you about the act of writing, and in particular, the act of writing The Splendid Table. Which, I mean, I guess maybe not everyone knows this, but the show, The Splendid Table, got its name from Lynn's first book, which was yeah. called The Splendid Table. I can't believe I'm even saying that. Like, they can probably figure that out. But Lynn, so before the show was even a glimmer in anyone's eye, Lynn was writing this book. It is a magnificent book, and it is an exhaustive and totally passionate exploration of the traditions of Emilia-Romagna.
Yeah.
Which, it's not, I don't think it's fair to even say, oh, it's a regional cookbook. It is truly an exploration of a place. Mm-hmm. And the act of writing that book, which you said took you over 10 years.
Yeah.
Changed you.
Tremendously. There's someone sitting in the audience who did much of the research with me, my dear friend Cara Da Silva. And we traveled together there. Cara's quite a journalist on her own right. Has written about food and food history for years and many other areas of scholarship. But I was living in Brussels, and I was 11 hours and 59 minutes, I guess, from downtown Parma, which is one of the major cities in Emilia-Romagna. It's a region that sits between Tuscany and the Veneto, okay? It's one of the wealthiest regions. It's the only place in Italy where Parmigiano Reggiano can be made, where the true balsamic vinegar can be made, and where Parma ham can be made. It's, you know, what would you call terroir, you know, subclimates, whatever you want to call it. And the traditions are amazing, these three incredible foods. But the reality was that I originally never thought of writing a book. I just kept going back because I kept learning so much. Mm. And what would happen is that, for instance, I didn't know anything about balsamic vinegar. I mean, at that time you could buy Fini balsamic vinegar, which was very nice. But when I wanted to learn more about it, and I had taken a class with Marcella Hazan years before that was the region where we were. Mm-hmm. And I knew a little bit about the fact that there was another kind of balsamico. And then talking to people in my Italian, I'd studied Italian pretty assiduously because I spoke a very backward form of it from the family. And not my family didn't, I did. But anyway,
because you want to be Chinese.
Well, that's right. Exactly. But I discovered people would send you to people in Italy and a lot of other places. I think you probably know this as well. When people think you're serious about something and they know you're very curious and you've expressed interest in something, they will pass you on.
Sure.
It's like saying, she's okay. And I ended up learning about the balsamic vinegar that for hundreds of years would be presented as a gift to an honored guest. A small barrel of it would be the dowry of a bride going to her family within that region, that there were balsamics that were hundreds of years old because of the system. The system is a system of a row of barrels from larger, smaller to larger, and that what happens is, and the barrels have holes in the top, so it's an evaporation process, and they're up in the attic, and the windows are open and whatever, and what would happen is that as you took from this littlest barrel, which would be the oldest vinegar, you never took it all. A third was, or a half was always left. And then you refill that with, from the next barrel, and the next barrel, and the next barrel. So the reality is that the vinegar you're taking from that little barrel every year, perhaps, parts of it go back to your great-great-great-great-grandmother. Mm. And a part of it may be from the harvest of last year. So I've written chapters about this. I'm not going to go into it. But I ended up in attics. This was before anybody knew this stuff or knew it existed. I had friends who lived 100 miles north. They prided themselves. They had a gourmet club. And when I mentioned to them that I was going down to Modena, which is the heartland of this, and I was going to spend some time with a balsamico, families did this, factories didn't do it. They said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "You know, balsamic vinegar." Huh. This was back in the early 80s. They had no idea what I was talking about. Well, this is like, I can't explain, it's a siren song. You kept going back again and again, learning how you cure a ham with only salt, no nitrates. And how do you keep that ham from spoiling when you're hanging it for 2 years? What's the science? And what had started me with that was years before, living in New York, and collecting country hams, because I had started to read the Foxfire series, and I'm not going to go into it, but look it up. This is some of the most valuable piece of Americana that we have in terms of what is food about in this country, what are people about, and this is about Appalachia, and it was talking about curing hams, and not the hams we get in the grocery store. These were hams that took years of cure, and you know, you slice them paper thin, and you even cook them. Anyway, everywhere my husband went, he traveled a lot in those days, he would bring home a ham, and I kept a ham diary, and we had a I don't think there's anything odd about that, you know.
Fabulous.
And so here I was in Italy.
I collected baseball cards when I was a kid.
What?
I collected baseball cards when I was a kid.
I don't know why you didn't get on hams. I mean, good Lord.
I should have.
So at any rate, here I was in this world of extraordinary foods and people who lived the past. Also, not just the past, not the romance of it, the realities of it.
Right.
Like, you quickly learn what that glorious peasant food that I used to write about from Bon Appetit and, you know, all of that. Well, the real food of the peasants wasn't all that romantic often. It was, I mean, usually people who worked in the field saw a piece of meat at Christmas and Easter, and it was from the cow that died, and we didn't want to know why. And, you know, when you look at ravioli and tortellini, which are, this is Sunday food, but what else would you do when you have a pound of meat and 12 people to feed?
Sure.
You stuff a pasta, and it becomes delicious. So I was fascinated, and we were then told we were going back to the United States a year early. And I was standing in the shower behaving in a very mature way. I was going to chain myself to the balcony. I had no desire to leave. I was just getting rolling. And the other thing is, I was going to write a book, and I didn't know what it was going to be. I had to pay tribute to the fact that I had been dropped into this world of the past, of the present, of extraordinary people doing extraordinary things and doing them in their backyard, doing them, you know. These were artisans before that ever became fashionable.
Sure.
And the love of the quality, not because they were esoteric and everybody was a gourmet, but because it was part of who they were. Of course you're going to make a good cheese. It's my family. You know, you think we'd ever make a bad cheese? It's that kind of thing. So the reality was that in the midst of that sobbing and whatever, I thought, I'm going to write a book about Emilia-Romagna. nobody's done this book about all the history of it, how it came about, why this food in this place that's different from the food over the mountains and across the river, which is true in every place in the world. Anyway, and it was about a year and a half before we were going to leave, and I started. I looked at all the notebooks. I used to photograph. I used to do something like 500 photographs a trip. And the great thing was I had a car. My husband was very understanding. And I could disappear for 4 weeks. I had no return plane ticket. I could drive. You know, if somebody, as things happened, you were going to go home on Tuesday, and then I'd call my husband. He'd say, I know. You know, and he'd maybe see me on Saturday, and then maybe not, because what had happened, what, you know.
Because Jacques was there.
And well, yes.
I hope you brought him some hams.
So that was the beginning of The Splendid Table. And the original idea was I wanted to talk about why certain things happen in a place. Why this food in this place? And I thought I'd start with Christ and move up. No, because...
Okay, can I tell you, I actually work as an editor at a publishing house. Like, if I got a proposal for a cookbook and said, I want to start with Christ and work my way up.
I did adopt a little bit because I had a come to Jesus moment. Because I couldn't justify the research. I couldn't do enough. But what had led to that was that this area includes the Po River Delta. Consider that to be the Mississippi of Italy, a very important area for trade, etc. And it turns out that there were Etruscans trading at that delta before Christ. And there's still evidence of the community. And what they were trading was fascinating to me. And there are historians. I mean, in Italy, I can't tell you how many professors there are that really focus on culinary history. There's clubs of men who are fascinated, and they all of them find old volumes, and they get together once a week, and they tell each other about them. I mean, it's just amazing. And one of those clubs was called the Capacchi Club in Parma. Capacchi was wonderful. Anyway, I was allowed to sit in, you know, this American with mediocre Italian. I mean, the privilege you have. So the reality was I decided I was going to write the 500 years in Emilia-Romagna, yeah, because the Renaissance was a really important thing there. And that was really the beginning of modern food. And this is where the awareness, all the interest I had in history and whatever, I learned something. Never trust what you read until you've checked it out. There's so many wonderful stories, and they're not true. I understand people are on deadlines and whatever, but you need time. You have to really know what you're talking about. And by the way, I spent 10 years researching. I could go back and do another 10. Oy vey.
So in that moment of writing that book, you know, food was no longer Cuisinart's in front of a crowd. It was no longer just about, oh, what's this technique and how do you make this? And, you know, how many, you know, cloves of garlic do you stuff in the chicken? It was history. It was science. It was tradition.
It was the beginning of that, which was really wonderful.
Yeah. And that, hold that thought, because that's going to get us to our next part. But actually, what's really going to get us to our next part, which is the intermission, is our dear friend, a very special guest. We get to welcome to the stage, Chris Thiele.
Here. We got to have that coffee.
Oh, we got to. I have a song about food. This is an old bluegrass song about food. One of the few that I know that's just sort of bald-facedly about the hunting, killing, and eating of an animal, in this case, a rabbit. It's a song I learned from, there's this wonderful old recording of Bill Monroe performing this song with Doc Watson. What is it called? Is it called Feast Here Tonight? I think it is.
Got a rabbit in a log, and I ain't got my dog, and how will I get him? I know
Gonna get me a Brian, I'll twist it in his hair, and that's where I'll get a mind. Oh, I know, I know, that's where I'll get a mind. Oh, gonna get me a Brian, I'll twist it in his hair, and that's where I'll get a mind. Oh. Shining bright, and find me a place to lie down, to lie down, to lie down. Find me a place to lie down. Have a feast here tonight for the moon shining bright, and find me a place to lie down. And a soles of my shoes are nearly gone, they're wore out. In a ways ahead, there's an old farmer's shed, and that's where I'll rest my weary bones. My weary bones, your lazy bones. That's where I'll rest my weary bones. A little ways ahead, there's an old farmer's shed, and that's where I'll rest my weary bones. Your lazy bones, that's where I'll rest my weary bones. A little ways ahead, there's an old farmer's shed, and that's where I'll rest my weary bones.
Yes, yes, yes.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Chris Feeley, ladies and gentlemen. I can't wait to come on your show and be like, 2 cups of olive oil, 3 cloves of garlic.
We'll be back with more in a minute about how our radio show started in the first place, and an amazing clip of an early Splendid Table interview with Julia Child where she was multitasking. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. This week's show is from our farewell conversation with Lynn, recorded live in front of 900 people at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota. You can hear the whole event, and it was really one to remember, on our podcast. So look for it wherever you get your podcasts. But right now, we're headed back to that theater, where we'll hear how Lynn and our co-creator Sally Swift started The Splendid Table 2 decades ago, back then in the wild west of food media.
Welcome back. And we have another guest.
Slipped me in.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Sally Swift.
Thank you.
So at the end of every show, we say, and our managing producer is Sally Swift. Actually, no, it's Sally Swift is our managing producer.
Yes.
But really, what's not obvious, I think, to the listener, is Sally is not just the managing producer. She is, as much as Lynn, the mother of this show. She...
Don't cry.
Lynn and I aren't looking at each other tonight. We're just...
Yeah, this seating was really great, because they're going to look at each other. They're going to cry. It's going to make for great, great entertainment. No, but the show actually started after the publication of The Splendid Table, the book. And there was a producer who read the book, had heard about Lynn, and thought, hey, I'm going to reach out to her and see if she wants to do something on the radio about food. And that person was Sally. So Sally, I actually don't know this. Why'd you do that?
Needed a job. No. Why did I do that? Actually, that's a really hard question, Frances. I loved food. I was a producer. I was working in television, doing pretty bad TV, actually. Shows right. in the 19, you know, the
height of shows.
Talk shows, daily talk shows. I had a child and suddenly wasn't interested in doing that production work any longer, and had gotten the Splendid Table. And I had, when I was in college, I waited tables. I loved food. I get this book, and it was unbelievable. It was absolutely everything that I loved about food, because for me, as Lynn talked about earlier, it's a hand. It all opens up. And I got the book, and I read. It's a big book, and I read it. I read it from cover to cover. And then I saw Lynn on Frugal Gourmet, and she was utterly charming. And cold called her, found out she lived in St. Paul, picked up the phone, called her. She was a little snotty. because she had won both she was the first person to ever win both the James Beard Award and the Julia Child Award for her book, which was amazing. And just, yeah. And we met for lunch and, well, what was lunch like?
Well, I remember my side of this. This is one of those split screen things, I think. After the book won both those awards, I was one. There were several flavors of the month, you know, last 10 minutes. And I love theater. I did a lot of theater, and I thought it would be great to do TV. And I was approached by producers. And every time I explained that I had written, it was going to be about the book, and I said, I've written a book about 500 years of eating, about the romance of the Renaissance, of history, of, you know, I mean, this could be really the kind of thing that if Jim Henson, who produced The Muppets, if you had Steven Spielberg, you know, which would be the movie side. The idea is you have so much imagination you can play with here. You could do kind of a little time-traveling thing. And I mean, it would just be, no, people won't pay for that. And then the other part of it was, and by the way, we think you're brilliant and you're going to be a star. And when you raise the money, we'll spend it for you. So I was getting very cynical about it. And Sally called and said, you know, what would you think about doing a radio show about food? And quite frankly, my first reaction was, oh, no, not another one. And I tried not to be rude, but as I sat over that lunch, I realized, my God, she's thinking about food the way I've been thinking about food, that it has all of these dimensions. And she'd read the book, and my God, she cooked from it. I mean, this thing is 518 pages, for God's sake. And so we started to talk. And because of your connections, we ended up getting the attention of Minnesota Public Radio. Mm-hmm. And they gave us a trial shot, as I recall, right?
We did that 4th of July special. We were both paid, I think, $80 each.
And oh, no, that you got more than I did.
No, and
we never talked about that,
right.
did we?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and we were off and kind of made it by benign neglect, I would say. We were low enough and cheap enough that we just kind of kept going. Jennifer Russell, who is here tonight, who is, yeah, you all know her. She was our first hire. My ex-husband, Tom Vagley, was the reason we really had NPR take a flyer on us, a very accomplished and amazing producer. So on his good name, NPR kind of let us go.
Yeah. What do you think the show was going to be?
Well,
I mean, not
brilliant.
In terms of success.
We thought,
like,
we were going to be brilliant.
But what did you want to do? Like, the show has evolved so much over the years and the early days.
Well, you know what? It hasn't evolved all that much from the early days. It's kind of interesting. I mean, we were always really interested in the same things that we've been covering now. I mean, people could not get over the idea of doing food on radio. Program directors were like, what? You know, what are you going to do?
It's going to be recipes. You're going to
read
recipes.
We're going to be talking about recipes, which we didn't have any desire to do. We were the first show at NPR to start with a website, which I hated because it was a beast I had to feed every week on top of everything else. And of course, that website is what kept us going for the longest time, because guess what? people wanted recipes. And so we got this whole other dual audience going.
And we were talking about, you hate to say you think you might be the first, but the reality is we were not in a lecturing kind of way, but in that idea of come on along, this is kind of an interesting trip we're taking here. We were first to talk about local and sustainable and organic before it was, you know, the watchwords. And not because it was the only way to go, but because this was important to think about. There were changes going on. And we wanted to look at food from all these different points of view. And I remember we had, there were some humorous pieces that were done. I remember one, remember Bix Skakel?
Yeah.
Yeah, he had been here. He had gone to L.A. to become a screenwriter. And he took a little time for him to become a screenwriter. So he would do these bits for us. And one of the bits that he did was talking about being raised here in the Midwest and that his family was diametrically the opposite of eating healthy. Everybody ate sugar and whatever. And then there was the aunt who had two children who would come and lecture them that they were all going to die. You know, they were going to become criminals and whatever. And he said, they were eating Pop-Tarts and popcorn. You know, they were eating a lot of fast food and that kind of thing. And she would, you know, she'd, oh my, you can't do this. And I think he ended it by saying that his cousins, now they were all grown up, I think one was in rehab and the...
one was in prison.
Yeah. And the other one was walking around in a shopping mall in a chicken suit.
Right, that's right.
Yeah. Now, there's nothing wrong with any of that, basically.
Judgment-free, Lynn Rosetta Casper specialty.
Yes.
Always
judgment-free. But it was just, he did it beautifully. You know, it's the kind of thing that you find yourself collapsing and laughing.
One of the real different things, I mean, when we started the show, we did it live, because it's a really inexpensive way to do it, and... it was pretty amazing. We had some pretty amazing experiences. Scary. We had no audience early on, we had a handful of friends that would call us every single Saturday on demand.
Whoa. It was a live call-in show.
Yep, with no
that
call-ins.
No one knew existed.
Exactly. You got it. That's exactly right. So I just scheduled callers. I had a girlfriend who's Jewish who would call. She'd go in the cloakroom of her synagogue and get on her cell phone and call in. I mean, it was total commitment. But right off the bang, you know, Lynn had such a great... She's so well-respected in the food community. We had... No one said no to us. And in fact, we're going to play you a clip that some of you... I'm sure have heard before, but it is a beauty. Julia Child was, I called, I'll never forget, I said, Julia, it's Sally Swift, and she goes, hello! I was like, it really is. I said, of course I'll do this, you know, so got her into the studio, and we're live at this point, and we're going to play this clip for you. I think it was our first month. She is so sure of herself and has done so much media. You need to listen.
Oh, don't tell them.
What?
Just play it.
You know, I have to tell you you have to listen, because what she's doing while she's being interviewed, reading the paper. Can we roll it?
Julia, welcome to the splendid table.
Well, it's lovely to be with you, Lynn.
It's good to have you here. And the first thing that I want to know is, how did you begin? Because from what I understand, you didn't grow up saying, I think I want to become a food professional.
No, I didn't at all. I was always very hungry. And my mother didn't cook at all, because I grew up in the teens and 20s when everybody just about had a maid, because it wasn't expensive. We had all the people, the immigration. And so almost everyone had a maid, so mother never cooked at all. She could make some funny kind of an English cheese dish. That was about it. But I'm interested in really kind of hobby cooking, where it's interesting to do. I don't want to just throw something on the table. And I don't know, there's some people who say you should use no more than 5 ingredients. Well, what kind of... That's not interesting, is it? And that's housewife's cooking. The Ménagère, and the French consider her about the dumbest person who ever walked down the pike.
When was the first time that it dawned on you that food was really important to you?
Well, it did. It did particularly during World War II, because we were over in China and India, and we had, I don't know who cooked the food. It was just dreadful. They had, you know, dried water buffalo, and it was just terrible food. But we were in China. We were able to go out and eat in the restaurants because we had some people who knew China. That food was delicious, and I think that's when it really dawned upon me what wonders could come out of the kitchen.
Then you went to France.
Yeah, then we got married, and I didn't really know how to cook at all. We wouldn't eat till about 10 at night. It took me so long. I was using The Joy of Cooking and Gourmet magazine, because I had to learn to cook. Then when I got over to France, this wonder of that food was so delicious. And so immediately, as soon as we got settled in, I went to the Cordon Bleu, and the more I got into it, the more I loved it, and the more I appreciated it as a true art form that you could spend your life over. So that's how I got into it.
Like, I want to know what page she was reading. She was like reading about, like, was it like the sports page?
I would bet
page,
it was the, like, Boston Globe, and it was probably the political page.
Yeah.
Because I can remember, well, I ended up staying with Julia when I was on tour with The Splendid Table, the book. And when Splendid Table was done, I was looking at it as though I had nothing to do with it. I was sort of overwhelmed. And also, it had gotten a lot of attention. So at any rate, here was Julia, the great compliment of staying in her home, which was wonderful. And she picked, she was much busier than I was, much busier. And there was a reception one night for the press and food people, and that's, she came to it. That was like this incredible endorsement. It was so generous of her. And afterward, we had dinner together, and we were talking, because we would meet every night in the kitchen for what she called a small libation. And we would have a little bit of gin on ice, and we'd have a little nibble of something, and we'd talk and tell goth stories, and it was lovely. But here I was sitting at the table with Julia Child, holy cow. I'd worked with her in the past, but I never got over this awe. And she said to me, she was asking me about how I did the book, why I did the book. And she said, you know, Lynn, it's a seminal work. Hmm. And I literally sat there, my eyes wide. I couldn't articulate. I just was dumb. And she looked at me and she said, do you know what the word seminal means? And again, it was this funny sense you have of you've worked and worked and worked over this thing for God knows how long, and, you know, prayed over it and rewritten it and all this, and you don't know it right now. You're going to get to know her. She's a baby, but you're not going to, but right, it's so going to work. Oh, my God. She was amazing. I loved her dearly. She was great. But we did, one of my favorite interviews that we did was Tony Bourdain. Now, before he wrote his first book, Kitchen Confidential, he had done a piece, I think it was for The New Yorker. What was the title?
We didn't interview him. We had him read the, we did it as a commentary. It was the piece that he wrote about
what life is like inside a restaurant.
What life is like inside the restaurant and how he never ordered fish on a Friday. It was that one little...
On a Monday.
Yeah. And he did it as a commentary.
That's right. Yes, he did. So at any rate, by the time this happened, Tony was moving along, and we were doing working with Gourmet Magazine. Gourmet Magazine used to have these annual events where people would come in from all over the country, and they could take classes, but they also were taken behind the scenes. And we were sort of the stage show to kick it all off. So now I'm on stage with Tony Bourdain and Thomas Keller. Now, Thomas Keller had a little outfit and still does called the French Laundry. In New York, he had opened a Per Se. He had other restaurants. And, you know, people, chefs, referred to him as the most talented cook in the United States.
And Tony Bourdain was still cooking at this time, too. So he was still running this little French, not
yeah,
big French
exactly.
bistro called Leal.
Yeah. And I had asked both of them, each of them, well, how did you get started in cooking? You know, what brought you into this world? And if we could have the tape.
I was a rotten kid. I didn't have any respect for anyone else. I had no respect for
myself. This is Tony,
myself.
In case you haven't figured that out. Yeah.
My roommates got sick of me loafing on vacation, and they got me a summer job washing dishes. Mm-hmm. And I looked around, and I said, for various reasons, I like this business. I like this lifestyle. I like this. I want to be a member of this tribe. It was the first time that I went home with something to feel proud about. It was the first bunch of people I met whose respect was important to me. I went home feeling like a champion. I was a very happy dishwasher. And just the cooks got, you know, more free liquor and better girls.
Now it comes down to it. Now it comes down to it. Now, Thomas, you didn't set out to go to restaurant school or, I mean, how did you come to food?
My mother. I mean, how do we all come to food? My mother ran restaurants when I was a child, and it was something that, as being the youngest of five boys, she was back in her career, and I would go to the restaurant after school, because that's where my mother was. And she would set me in front of the dishwasher, and I thought it was such a fascinating thing. You put something in that was dirty, and 30 seconds later, it came out clean. I mean, this was an amazing thing to a young boy. So growing up in that back of the house role was something that I always did. But of course, there was job security there. My mother wouldn't fire me.
Yeah. I want to get a picture of how both of you work. So here's the setup. It's Friday night. You're in the middle of the worst part of the rush. I walk into your kitchen. Thomas, what would be my first impression?
Well, hopefully you're impressed with what you see. Hopefully that, you know, we're professionals in what we do. We've been doing it for a long time. You're going to walk into our kitchen, wherever it is, whether it's French Laundry, Bouchon, or Per Se, and be impressed in an inspiring way. And what I mean by that is looking at a group of people that are collectively working together for a common goal, not just in the kitchen, but in the entire restaurant.
Uh-huh. Is it noisy? I mean, is it?
It shouldn't be noisy. No. We try to keep the chaos. I mean, you've heard it before. It's controlled chaos.
Yeah.
And that's what it's about. I mean, chefs are control freaks, are they not, Tony?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's the root of who we are. But you don't want to have a situation where it's chaos in the kitchen. No.
Leal, Friday
well,
night.
Slightly more civilized at Thomas. Okay, Friday night. Well, I'm cursing affectionately. Affectionately. Uh-huh. I'm probably on my second margarita. They're playing Mexican hardcore over by the grill station. Uh-huh. The busboys are squeezing behind me. It looks chaotic, but the food is coming up. It's going out on time. It's going to the right customers. It's properly cooked, and we're not getting any plates. There are no returns coming back from the floor. So it is about control, but it's two very different control systems. Mm-hmm. I tend to foster a us versus them mentality in the kitchen that I find very useful in you know, team spirit. You know, it's the dust boat principle of restaurant management.
But the result's the same. I think that's the important thing. So there's many ways to get to a successful result.
We have slightly lower standards.
What a career he has gone on to have, right? He's taken food and turned it into, gone down paths that you would never imagine.
And exactly what you should be doing with food today. I mean, it's not that it's not wonderful to watch somebody cooking in a kitchen, but you look at what Tony's done in taking us into people's lives, into the politics, into the life of a place, and it's not always about the fanciest restaurant or, you know, the famous chef. I love what he does.
I'm going to leave, but before I do, people always ask, you know, what's Lynn really like? Well, so we've put together a little behind-the-scenes tape for you that Lynn has not heard. And with that, I'm going to depart.
All right. Yes, here we go.
Are you ready? You stinker.
Deathless Radio is about to happen.
Hi, everybody. It's Lynn, Corinne, Claudia, Teresa, Anne, Rossetto, Casper, and if you're still listening, this is The Splendid Table from American Public Media, and now I'll do that one more time. I feel a burp coming on.
Oh, and we have a caller up. Now you know.
Hi, Lynn. How are you? I love your belt, too.
Up in the air, Junior Birdman. Up in the air, upside down. Up in the air, Junior Birdman. And keep your flippers off the ground.
How many times has a whiff of something... A whiff. That's like a waft, except it's a whiff of a waft. Don't make fun of the host. Takashi Hagihishi. Takashi Yagihashi. Chef Takashi Yagihishi. Takashi Yagahashi. Takashi. Why can't his name be
May
Smith?
They never do this.
George Clooney. You know, I live in hope. I actually met a chicken named Corey that I could make a pet out of in a hot minute. She's this little golden chicken, and she's just so sweet. And when you hold her, she just goes, cuckoo, cuckoo. Which probably in chicken talk means, get your filthy hands off me. It's the sex kitten voice that really matters. A little sexy caramel in there. A little breathiness there. Keep feeling like I'm doing phone sex.
Oh, I missed that.
Well, I'm so glad that's over.
Oh, literal tears. We have literal tears.
Yeah, well, for two reasons. Any kind of distinguished, elegant kind of image I may have perhaps hobbled together is blown out of the water. That is all out. You're going to meet her in a little while. This is our technical director, Jennifer Lubke, who is someone who, yes, yes. Jennifer, if you know, the music you hear, the cuts you hear, this is the woman who spends 20 minutes working on a breath to get it right. And she promised me she would never, ever use any of that material in public.
Look, I'm going to have to be honest. Like, 22 years you've hosted this show, Lynn. If that's all you've got after 22 years, I mean, you're...
Francis, we'd empty out the theater, really.
I mean, you're doing pretty good. Even if that doing pretty good is like... encourage, like, loving your staff to the point where they don't want to embarrass you further. I think that's probably pretty commendable.
That's such a nice way to put it. Thank you so much.
I also have to say, I was there when they were cutting this thing yesterday, and there were some choice bits they did leave out.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm so glad.
Including one where, mysteriously, you talked about wanting to take off your blouse during the...
What?
I swear to God. It was Lynn saying, I'm going to take off my blouse. And it was funny, because I heard it. You know,
God, it was my hot flash period. Come on. Half of you know what I'm talking about, at least.
No. I can actually totally relate, because I record often in my home.
Right.
They sent me this, like, sweet little microphone set up. I can do it in my home. I live in a little apartment in New York, in Brooklyn. But here I am in my home, literally, like, not even changing out of my pajamas.
Yeah.
Making great radio. But, like, the deal when you record at home is it's not actually a studio, right? So you got to close all the windows, and you close and you try to make a somewhat soundproof environment, which means I didn't think about it. I was like, oh, this is so great. I can do this at home. And I didn't realize, oh, it's July. So all my windows are closed. You can't turn on air conditioning. And I was sweating so profusely one day recording this show. I literally did it buck naked. Sweat running down my body. And I was like,
you know what? We should find out which show that was.
Then you can hear him trying not to pass out. This is really going to be wonderful entertainment. But I actually do want to ask you something. That's only tangentially related. I've mastered the art of the transition. What has been hard about doing the show for you? What has been difficult?
I think what has been difficult is that we've talked to so many people that have so much to say. and there's so much background material to what they're talking about, whether it's politically related, it's about science, it's about what's happening in the world, it's about someone who's, you know, writing about a part of the world, writing about food. And sometimes I wish we could do a 20-minute segment where you could give a complete, you know, completely couch who you're talking to. And I guess the other thing that was hard was when the call-in stopped, because I loved call-in. I loved it. And I think the other thing is, I've always thought it would be an interesting idea as issues evolve, especially issues that everybody's aware of, to do kind of a round table show where you have a variety of expertise. You know, so you could be talking to the scientist, you could be talking to the anthropologist, you could be talking to, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson about the effect on the universe. But the hardest thing for me, I think, has always been getting it right. It's never perfect. And that's the joy of it, too, because every time you go at it, it's another go-round, it's another shot, another try at it. And thank God at times it's so ephemeral. Because sometimes you wish, maybe they won't remember this one. Not the whole show, but, you know, you've goofed in some way. So I don't know if that answers the question in the way you wanted it answered, but that's basically it.
I mean, I selfishly asked that question because, you know, it's a little bit of wanting advice from you, too, as I do this.
It's very hard to, you know, and I'm not saying this is... We do more in this show in terms of investigating dimensions and bringing on unusual people and whatever, and I think it's a really good job that's done. But there's so much out there. There's so much backdrop. There's so many dimensions, especially today with what's happening with our environment and, you know, in other areas as well. There's so much to say.
Yeah.
But then again, that's all ahead of you. I mean it, though. Yeah. You're the person who can do that. And that's going to be really exciting.
Thank you. I mean, I said this to you last week, but I feel so incredibly honored that you've asked me to do this, that I have the opportunity to do this. I mean, having listened to the show for so many years, and having, just from the perspective of a listener, this feeling that you've taken us on this journey of curiosity, which you clearly still have. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, you know, your choice to move on to other things is not because this stopped being fascinating. It's not because it stopped being interesting to you. And you know, that journey has been so meaningful, not just to me, but just to have that person who's in your home, in your life, every week, to talk about these things that really matter, to talk about these things. And sometimes they matter in different ways. They matter in the ways you're talking about, in the ways that, food connects to all these difficult issues, and it's important for us to talk about them. But also in the way of providing that moment of escape, providing that moment of, here's a thing that I can just love, you know? Actually, I'd love to cue up one last bit of tape. This is an interview you did with a chef, Pierre Chem, who is the author of a book called Senegal. Let's listen to that tape, if you don't mind.
Pierre, there's something, a word that you use a lot in the book, terenga. Mm-hmm. And there's also, the subtitle of the book is From the Source to the Bowl, not the plate. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, let's start with the bowl. What is the significance of the bowl in Senegal?
Well, the bowl is the vessel in which we eat, first of all. We eat around the bowl in Senegal, or in most of Africa, for that matter. The bowl symbolizes unity. We eat together. Eating is something that's not done in a separate way. In Senegal, you always stop everything when it's mealtime and everyone gets together. And the bowl is that magnet that unifies the family, that brings friends and family together. And again, you mentioned teranga. Teranga is the word that symbolizes Senegal the best, I think. You know, teranga is a wall of wood that would translate hospitality. But Teranga is much more than just hospitality. It's the most important value. If there's a set of values in Senegal, Teranga would be the most important one. It's the way you treat the guest. It's the way you treat the other, you know, the one who is not you. That person becomes the one you have to offer Teranga. You have to treat him with so much respect. You have to offer him what you have. You have to invite him to sit around your bowl. There's always room for the other around your bowl. And why? Because we believe that the other is bringing blessings. So when you share your bowl will always be plentiful. This is the Senegalese, the deep-rooted Senegalese belief. We believe that there's always more. You will never lack by sharing. Actually, when you share, you guarantee yourself that tomorrow there's more. There's going to be more food in your bowl, and so on and so forth. So this is a country that values the wealth of a person not by how much he has, but by how much he shares, by how much he gives. That's what I would say to summarize what Teranga means. Just not one word that describes it, but Teranga is what Senegal is. It's just this value has been encrusted in us that we have to treat the other as the most important person in the world.
Now, I wanted us to have a moment to listen to that because I remember listening to the show. Mm-hmm. It was on my headphones. I remember when that came on, and I was walking to work, and I literally stopped in the middle of the street, and I could not believe what I just heard because that message was so powerful, especially in our lives in this moment, but always. And now, and it's just a, like a driveway moment, right? That's a cliche. I had that only it was like in the middle of the street and there was a bus like bearing down on me, so I ran to the other side of the street. But I wanted to bring it up because that clip always stays in my mind. That clip stays in my mind in this moment because it makes me think of what you've given us. It makes me think of how you treat people on the radio, how you've treated people when you've talked with them 600 episodes later, 635 or whatever the number is, how many thousands of people have called you. It's always been clear to me that you treat others that way. And for us to be a part of that, even just as listeners, is a gift. And it's funny because you talk about Julia telling you that The Splendid Table, the book, was a seminal work. Well, The Splendid Table, the show, is a seminal work. You have two seminal works with the same title. How's that happen?
Well, Francis brought me to tears, which is why I didn't get a chance to thank him for an extraordinary evening. And I didn't get a chance to thank Chris Thiele, who came to play for us and with us. And to thank my cohorts, Jen Russell, producer and social media guru, Jenny Lubke, our tech director who works magic with how we sound, Chip Walton, associate digital producer, Courtney McEwen, associate producer who keeps us all in line, and Sally Swift, my partner in creating the show and our managing producer. And not to forget the amazing crew at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, and of course, American Public Media. But frankly, my greatest thanks is to you, because without you, we wouldn't be here. You are the best, and it's been a privilege and an honor to take this ride with you. I know you'll support Francis as you have me. A heartfelt thank you for all these good years. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all
across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.